2 Samuel chapter 9. Then David said, then what? Hopefully you've been reading along, following along. Remember we saw in chapter 7, David was planning to build a temple. Nathan the prophet said, sure, go for it. Then God told him in the night, don't you say go for it. Go tell him he's not going to be the guy to do it. He did bless David, gave him victories, promised not only a kingly line, but a messianic line that the Christ would come through his lineage, that he would establish his throne forever. And the last we saw was David in chapter 8 administering justice and righteousness for all the people of Israel. So now we pick up in 2 Samuel chapter 9. Then David said, is there yet anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? David, the last we saw, was administering righteousness and justice, the kind of politician, the kind of country's leader that we wish that we had throughout our history and continued to have. And David now, not just corporately as the leader of an entire nation, wanting to show kindness, justice, and fairness, but also to bless Saul's family. Now, if you followed along with this study with us in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you know that David had little to no reason to really be a blessing to Saul or his family. Remember that Saul and David's relationship started off on the right foot, that Saul had been tormented by an evil spirit, and it seemed that when David played the harp and sang his psalms in the presence of Saul, that the spirit would leave him, that he was comforted. And it said that Saul loved David, but Saul had some problems, not only with the evil spirit, but with jealousy and his fleshly nature. And so when they were facing up against the Philistines, and every day for 40 days, I think it was, that Goliath the Philistine, a massively tall, 9.5 feet tall, guy came out and said, come on, you guys, one-on-one. Whoever wins this battle will win the war, and I'll pick me, and you guys can pick one of you, you know. And insulting the nation of Israel and the God of Israel. Well, David, he came to deliver some pizzas there, or what was it, bread and cheese. And he came out to the battle line, happened to be there when the Philistine Goliath came out to say this kind of stuff. And he was insulted. How can anybody insult the God of Israel? I'll go fight this guy. You know, I may only be, 4'1", or, you know. David was a young man at the time, at least 17, 18 years old, maybe more. But he knew that God doesn't need somebody big to fight somebody big. We'll talk about that a little bit more on Sunday. God didn't need somebody big to fight somebody big. And so, you know the story from Sunday school. David picked up 5 smooth stones, twirled one of them around in his sling, and let him have it, and the rock sank into his forehead. The word sank meaning like a stone sinking into the sea or into a pond, just boonk, you know, right in there, burying itself in there. Goliath dropped over dead. Well, that was okay with the Israelites. But on the way home, Saul heard the latest top 10 hit. And the top 10 hit was the lady singing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. That was the beginning of Saul's problem with David. Jealousy. Oh, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. And Saul got to the point where he was throwing his spear at David, trying to pin him to the wall, trying to have him ensnared by marrying his daughter, not the kindest woman, not the most honest woman, not the most godly woman. Figured, hey, if he marries her, that makes him number one on the public enemy list. If he becomes the king's son, well, when he goes out to war, the Philistines or the Canaanites, whoever were fighting at the time, that guy is going to have a big red X painted on his shirt, you know, a big target there. Didn't seem to work. David wasn't killed. Saul just got so angry with him that he figured, hey, might as well just kill him. We sent some guys there. David had escaped, but his wife had put the family idol in the bed with a goat's hair wig or whatever it was, and put him in the bed, put that thing in the bed there, and the soldiers came to arrest him. And she said, "Well, he can't be killed now. He's sick. You know, you can't arrest him and kill him now. He's got a fever. We want him perfectly healthy before we kill him." And so the guys came back. Saul said, "Why didn't you bring David again?" "Well, he's sick." "Well, bring him down in his bed then. I'll kill him right where he lays." And, you know, it turned out that David had escaped. And so Saul, for years, went out with his army pursuing David. Wherever David went, in the wilderness, Saul would pursue him and try and kill him. And many times David had an opportunity to stab Saul in the back, to impale him as he slept. But never did he do that. And Saul just kept pursuing him and pursuing him. And finally, David despaired and said, "Saul's going to one day kill me. There's nothing left for me here in the land of the people governed by God, the land of Israel." And went and had a really bad season there, living among the Philistines and becoming almost one of them. Well, Saul and the Philistines went to battle. Saul and all but one of his sons were killed. And David could have rejoiced, but he refused to rejoice. He wrote a song about how noble and valiant and strong Saul was. When he found out, when a guy came and said, "Oh yeah, I found Saul and I killed him," David had him killed. When the remaining son of Saul, Ish-bosheth, when he took the throne, David refused to go to war against him. Even when the men that were following him were battling with the men following Ish-bosheth, he refused to speak an unkind word against the rightful heir of Israel, the son of the king. And finally, when a couple of Ish-bosheth's own guys betrayed him and came to David and said, "Hey, we killed Ish-bosheth while he was taking a nap, you know, that lazy guy taking a nap in the afternoon. We killed him, and now, you know, you can be the king." David said, "No, what's going to happen is you guys are going to be killed. You strike an innocent man in his bed." Had both of them killed as well. And so David had this place in his heart that can only be personified, I think, by the teaching of Jesus, blessing those who curse you and loving those who hate you and praying for those who persecute you. Well, what an example. When David finally did take the crown, you'd think, hey, he's a pretty powerful guy. He's just this last chapter, he's defeated all these enemies. He's defeated the Philistines, and he's defeated the Arameans, and he's defeated all kinds of the Moabites, and all kinds of these guys. And you'd think that now David could afford to drop the facade and reveal that he's really not this nice of a guy. He was just making a power play, you know. He wasn't really community service minded. He was just trying to get up to the Congress or whatever it is. He's trying to raise his place. And now that he's made it, he can show his true colors and he's really evil. But he's administering righteousness and justice. And he says, I really want to bless the house of Saul. Is there anybody left? Oh, man, David, you're killing me here. You know, just when I thought that you couldn't outdo me anymore, now you're taking your sworn enemy and saying, how can I bless? I can't bless Saul anymore. He's dead. I can't bless Jonathan anymore. He's dead. But maybe there's somebody in Saul's house. Maybe there's somebody, some descendant of Saul that I can show kindness to. For the sake of Jonathan, if nothing else, for the sake of Jonathan. Remember that in 1 Samuel 20, Jonathan had made a covenant with David saying, go in safety inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. And so there was this covenant, a strange decision on David's part to seek out the descendants of Saul to bless them, because in that generation, in that time, in that ancient biblical history, what we see in scriptures and out of the scriptures, just in secular history, is when a new king took over, he also would search out any descendants of the previous administration, but to kill them. To kill them. You don't want some kid, you know, that's a grandson of the last king to grow up and challenge your right to the throne and get the people behind him. Well, yeah, we miss this king. We miss his family. We want him on the throne. So what they would do is they would capture them and kill them in the most brutal ways. I won't go into the historical data to gross you out on how they would kill these guys, but they would kill every last family member. And David, wanting to search out any family member of Saul, but to say, how can I show kindness? How can I show him kindness? Someone from the house of Saul, for Jonathan's sake. Now, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. And they called him to David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. He's probably pretty nervous himself, having been a servant in the house of Saul. And the king said, is there not yet anyone in the house of Saul? Oh, here it comes. To whom I may show the kindness of God? Huh? Ziba was probably fearing for his life and for any existing family members of Saul. And here, I want to show the kindness of God to him. And Ziba said to the king, well, there is still a son of Jonathan who's crippled in both feet. So the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he's in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, there in Lo Debar. A son of Jonathan, a grandson of King Saul. If any other king had taken the throne, he certainly would have been put to death. How was he lame in both feet? Do you remember that? Remember when Saul and Jonathan were killed? And this young son, I think he was 5 years old, son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, his nurse. You say Mephibosheth and then say nurse. His nurse picked him up and ran, afraid of the invading Philistines. Tripped, dropped him. Mephibosheth fell, was injured. We saw that in 2 Samuel 4. Now, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Israel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. And so because of a fall, he couldn't walk. The nurse had dropped him or somehow tripped. He had somehow tripped as she was dragging him behind. And he fell and he couldn't walk. He was lame in both feet. And so he's living in this the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, located in Lo Debar. The servants of Saul are no longer serving the house of Saul. He's off in maybe not an orphanage, maybe a family that just took him in. We don't know anything about Machir or his house. But King David sent in verse 5 and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lo Debar. Now, this must have been terrifying because, you know, all this time, he was only 5 at the time, but when David finally took the throne, he was, I forget the numbers now, around 9, 10, 11, old enough to know that when you're a descendant of the king and a new king comes in, you know what's going to happen to you. So they probably didn't publicize it a whole lot. The people probably wouldn't rally around him to his aid. We don't want a king in a wheelchair. Remember FDR? I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember him or read about him, but when he took ill and ended up in a wheelchair, they tried their best to make sure that the media never presented him in that negative light of, oh, look, our crippled president, or our, look at him on crutches, or look at him in the wheelchair. They thought it was a sign of weakness. So you can imagine back in the day when the king had to be a strong, strapping, fighting man. Well, we wouldn't get behind him. Mephibosheth was as good as dead if he was ever discovered. The people wouldn't back him, and certainly the king, the new king, would want to kill him. And so now the time has come. Word has come. King David wants to see you now. And he must have been just quaking and shaking. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, and prostrated himself. And David said, Mephibosheth. When I read this, I imagine that there was probably something in David's voice. Something that must have let Mephibosheth know, this guy's not about to kill me. Must have spoken his name in love. You know, one word spoken in love can be so powerful. Remember when Mary had come to the garden tomb 3 days after Jesus was killed and saw the tomb was empty and figured, they moved him. They moved him out of Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. What have they done? Did they just bury him in a commoner's grave? Did somebody steal the body? What have they done? And she turned around and saw the gardener and said, where have they taken him? Where have you taken him? And suddenly the gardener said, Mary. And she realized it wasn't the gardener. It was Jesus. Just in one word, Mary. And I imagine, although David probably not as powerfully speaking the name, but not angrily, not with hate, but actually saying, Mephibosheth. Saul was dearly loved by David. Jonathan loved even more. Their souls were knit together. Here's the son of the best friend that David ever had. And he can't walk. And now he's lying, trembling in fear, fallen on his face before the king. And David speaks his name with compassion and not hate. And he said, here is your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan. And he will restore to you and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul. And you shall eat at my table regularly. Again, he prostrated himself and said, what is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? What a place of humility, expecting to be killed and suddenly being told that he's going to be blessed. Suddenly being told, I'm going to be blessed because you loved my father and because you loved my grandfather, and you're going to restore to me all my grandfather's lands. He was the king. Remember when Samuel, the prophet, was being demanded of by the people of Israel, we want a king. He warned him, he said, you know, if you get a king, he's going to demand the choicest of your lands. He's going to demand your sons as servants. He's going to take the choicest of the produce of your lands. And they said, we don't care. We want a king. And that's what Saul did. Saul took the most powerful men, the sons of families, and saying, I want you in my army, I want you in my army, I want you in my army. And he'd look at other people's servants and say, well, that's a good servant. I want you in my house. You're a great servant. I want you in my house. And, oh, look at this fruitful land. You know what? We're annexing this for the kingdom. Sorry. And so Saul had many lands. And now this crippled young man who thought just a minute ago that he was about to be killed suddenly realizes, I've got a lot of land, and I'm going to eat at the king's table regularly? Wow. Life can change so quickly. Isn't it amazing? That's why we play the lotto every week. No. That's what people are counting on. Life can change so quickly in the hand of God. God can turn it around. Remember when Nathan was being talked to by God, saying, you know, you shouldn't have told David that he could build the temple because I don't want him to. But I do want to tell you this. I want you to go to David and say, remember when you were just a young man, a little boy, playing your harp in the field? You were a shepherd of sheep. You were a young shepherd over sheep, and today I've made you king over the greatest nation in the world. God can do things like that. God can take somebody from the mailroom and make him CEO. God can take somebody that's strung out and lunacized on drugs and make him the pastor of one of the biggest churches in San Diego. God can do anything. And he can take a crippled young man who's got No servants, doesn't even know where his next meal's coming from, hiding out, afraid that if he's ever discovered, he'll be killed. And say, in the course of one sentence, you're going to become an adopted son of the king. You're going to own all the land that King Saul owned. And more than that, even. More than that. And he's so humbled, he says, what is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? A dead dog. The expression dead dog is used 3 times in the Bible. It was interesting to me that it wasn't a lot more. A dead dog. It kind of rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? It's obviously a term of self-abasement. A dead dog. Nobody likes that. But when we think of dead dogs, and sorry to spend any time on this, when we think of dead dogs, when do you see a dead dog? You always see it. It's gotten loose, and it gets hit on the freeway. You know, because now we have a society where we go 75 everywhere. Well, nobody ever went 75 doing anything. Even when they fell off a cliff, they weren't going 75. And so we think of dogs, and a lot of times, you know, you run through a lot of emotions like, ooh, gross, you know. But sometimes the dog just looks okay, but it's dead. You know, it's on the side of the road, and it looks just like maybe your dog that's just asleep, but you know it's not asleep. And it grieves you because, you know, a lot of us are dog people. I mean, not people that are dogs. We love dogs. We're dog people. Some of us are cat people, and we'll pray for you. And then there's and then there's dog people. And so when I think of a dead dog, it grieves me. But understand that dogs, to a Jew, dogs were used, number one, as watchdogs over property or over sheep, the herds. But they were not pets. They were not things that you welcomed and slept up on your covers at night and you know, you got them the special kibble treats or whatever. Dogs were hated, and they were actually feared. Many of them were feared because most cities had packs of wild dogs running all throughout. And actually, you can look this up in the scriptures, but there is a saying in 1 Kings. It shows up in three times just in 1 Kings that there's the saying that the Jews would say, anyone who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. I mean, so, you know, if you happen to drop over dead, you know, you were more than likely going to get found by the pack of wild dogs before you were going to get found by anybody else. And so they feared them. Psalm 59:6 and 59:14 talk about the stray dogs that run around scavenging. And so we get this expression, dead dog. You know, what is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? Remember when King Saul was pursuing David in the wilderness? And David had a chance to kill Saul once again and didn't. And shouted from, I think it was the top of a cliff, somewhere where he was kind of a safe distance. And he said, after whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? David was calling himself that. You're the king. Why are you chasing after me? I'm a single flea. I'm a dead dog. I'm nothing. We're going to see also in 2 Samuel, further on into chapter 16, Shimei, a guy who was throwing dust and rocks at David, saying, you're a bloody man, and insulting him. Abishai turns to David and says, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. We'll see what happens when we get to chapter 16. A dead dog again. It was a term of self-abasement. I'm a dead dog. I'm a single flea. Or going, let me cut off that dead dog's head. And so we think of it as, oh, gross. But think about it from the Jews' perspective. The Jews' perspective, how they hated dogs. They hated dogs so much that they have to actually name Gentiles after them. You know, you know, Fluffy and Scooter and Spot, you know. No, they called them dogs. That was one of the words that they used for Gentiles, were dogs. That's how much they hated dogs. And so this dead dog, you can, if we were to put it in our vernacular, in our speech, what we would say is Mephibosheth is saying, what is your servant that you should regard a road-killed skunk like me? A squished cockroach like me? You know, something just repulsive. And so, you know, okay, so that's the dead dog thing. Anyway, then the king called Saul's servant, Ziba, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him. And you shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, according to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do. And so Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. Man, how life can change. Not only does he get the land, not only is he going to eat at the king's table, but he's going to have servants. All the servants of Saul's house are now restored to Mephibosheth. All the benefits that he would have had he not had this fall, had he not been lame and prevented him from walking, all those things would have been his. But now, because of the edict of the king, because of the mercy of the king, are going to be his. And I see a picture of us in Mephibosheth. Us, the dead dogs. That's what we could rename the church. Church of the Dead Dogs. Because if you think about it, none of us could walk either because of a fall. Our great, 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 great grandparents, Adam and Eve, they had a fall. They fell into sin. And you know, before that, they used to walk in the cool of the day with the Lord in the garden. But once they fell into sin, they couldn't walk with God anymore. God went for his walk, and Adam and Eve were hiding. They couldn't walk. And try as we might have been to be good people, some of you actually tried to be a good person, I didn't even bother, couldn't walk because you had fallen. And you were as good as a dead dog. I was as good as a dead dog. And interesting that Mephibosheth, he was living in Lo Debar. Lo Debar means no pasture, not a pasture. It's a place of nothingness. It's where we were. Lame, couldn't walk because of a fall, living in a place of nothingness. We haven't been led to any pastures. And then the mercy of our greater than David, Jesus Christ, the son of David, the root of David, called to us and blessed us and gave us what we might have inherited but didn't and certainly didn't deserve, and adopted us as one of the king's sons that we will someday eat at his table. We will someday eat at his table at the marriage supper of the Lamb. That last supper that the disciples ate with Jesus, he said, I won't drink from the fruit of the vine again until I drink it new in the kingdom of God at the Lord's table. You will eat with me at my table. Come and join me at the table. And that's what David did for Mephibosheth, and that's what our greater than David, our root of David, Jesus Christ, did for us. Now, interesting, if he ate at the king's table, he still couldn't walk. He was still lame. But David didn't say, okay, you're going to eat at my table, and after eating once, saying, what's the deal? Why are you still in that wheelchair? Why are you still on those crutches? Come on, straighten up. And yet, we assume that God does that to us. We know that God's doing it to other people. Well, come on, straighten up. When are you going to get this walking thing down right? Mephibosheth never did. But that was okay with David. He was one of the king's sons. He was an adopted child. And you know what? When Mephibosheth sat at the table, he looked like everybody else. When you're sitting at a table, you're not seeing people's feet. You're not seeing their legs. We're all equal when we're sitting at a table. And we're all equal at the table of God, at the Lord's table, at the king's table. I never got a chance to eat there, the king's table. Now it's the Armadillo. Anybody remember that restaurant? Yeah, anybody ever eat there? Was it bad? That's why it's closed. Well, I promise you, this king's table will be far better. And we'll all be equal. Because the fact that we weren't able to walk, that'll be hidden. It'll be under the table. And so God relocates us from Lo Debar, no pasture, and he leads us to green pastures beside still waters. What a perfect picture. So if you're having trouble walking, understand you're an adopted son of the king. And he did that not because of your ability to walk. He did it because he loves you. He had mercy on you. The grace of God appeared. And you were the benefactor. I was the benefactor. What a blessing. How awesome that is. And so Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Michah. And all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly, and he was lame in both feet. Look at the fruit. Number one, Mephibosheth had a son. He reproduced. A lame walk, but you can still reproduce. And you can make more children of the king. Now, some of you are doing that biologically. That's great. But you can do that spiritually as well. You can share with the folks at work. You can share with the neighbors. You can share with your family. And you can let them know. You know what? The king doesn't care that you're a dead dog. Probably not the best opening line. The king doesn't care that you're lame. And you know what? You are lame. No, the king wants to bring you to his table as an adopted son, not because of what you've done, but because of his grace, because of his mercy, because of his love. That is such a great picture. So he reproduced his son Michah. He named him Michah, means who is like Yahweh? Who is like our Yahweh? Who is like our root of David? None. None at all. None at all. Who is like him? And he's still lame, but that doesn't matter. All who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. Everything was restored. All the benefits of being the grandson of a king were restored. You know, everything that Adam and Eve lost for us and our sin kept us from gaining, God's grace appeared and restored to us all the riches in Christ Jesus. All those heavenly rewards, all those earthly blessings have all been restored to us. And it's funny how we, just talking with a brother today, is in some dire straits, didn't know how God was going to provide for him. And so as we were in that phone call and we were both racking our brains, he said, I've been racking my brain for 3 days. I don't know how God's going to do this. And I said, I don't know how God's going to do it either, but let's ask him. So right there on the phone, we just prayed and said, Lord, you know, we're able to only do so much, and it's all through you anyway, and we know you want to do the whole thing. And so, Lord, we're just asking how you're going to do it. We're affirming our complete faith in you that you're going to do it. Because, Lord, the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to you, and every once in a while you call up the butcher and you say, hey, let's butcher up one of these cows and sell it, you know. Let's fill somebody's freezer. And so I said, Lord, if you want us to, if you're going to provide by us coming up with a great idea, give us a great idea. Even right now while we're praying on the phone, give us a great idea. And if not, we just by faith are going to trust you and say, Lord, we don't know how you're going to do it, but we know you're going to. We have your promises that we will never be without what we need. Oh, we may want for years and years things that we want, but what we need, God, you always provide. So we said amen, I said, "Brother, did you get any good ideas?" He said, "No." I said, "Neither did I." So we agreed, God's going to do it. And you know, I talked to him later, and he had a great praise report. God did it. It was amazing. Totally out of the blue. Just something completely unexpected. Now, never in a million years would I have guessed that it would have been done this way. But it was done, and God did it. And so, God, all the riches, all the blessings, all the abundance of Christ that he gave to his son gives to us. That doesn't mean we're all going to be driving Rolls and living on the up on the hill. It means that God's taken care of us, and he can do exceedingly abundantly above all that we could ask or think. We're the inheritors of these things. And so suddenly, in a matter of a minute, he gets all these servants, all these lands, and they're serving him, and he procreates Micah, who is like Yahweh, and he's eating at the king's table regularly as one of the king's sons. Now, it happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, became king in his place. Then David said, "Well, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me." So David sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, "Well, do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search the city, to spy it out and overthrow it?" Well, here's David just on a roll, given kindness left and right. We know that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, at some point showed kindness to David. We don't know when that is or when that was, but we presume it was in his wilderness adventure there when he was running away from Saul. And maybe when David had spent some time in Moab, remember, he took his parents there and said to the king, "Hey, can you take care of my parents?" And Nahash's kingdom was right next to the Moabite kingdom there. It may have been at that time, but for whatever reason, he had shown kindness, and David wanted to repay it. And now that Nahash had died, he thought, "Well, the least I can do is send, you know, better than a get-well card, send some comfort or send some consolers, send my best wishes and my concerns to his son, who's now become king." Mixed blessing, you become king, but it's at the price of the death of your father. And just to say he's sorry. And it was looked upon with disdain that the princes of the new king of the Ammonites said, "You think anybody's this nice? The king of Israel this nice? Not a chance. These guys are spies. These guys are spies." So they mistrusted his kindness here. So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. When somebody's reading King James, apparently. It's times like this that I'm really glad I'm not reading the King James. Anyway, you can pass that around like a note during class if you want. But Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips, and sent them away. When they told it to David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly humiliated. And the king said, "Stay at Jericho until your beards grow, and then return." Can you imagine how freakish this must have looked? Somebody just had the King James passed to them, apparently. There are some words in the King James I wouldn't say in church. I'm telling you. Shaved off half their beards. You know, some of us look pretty ugly without a beard. And you know who those guys are because they're all wearing a beard. Because we know how we look without them. But to shave off half of them, think of how humiliating that would be. Well, again, to the Jew, and really to the cultures of that day, the beard was the sign of manhood. It was the sign also of freedom, because the slaves were shaved. And so having a beard spoke of my freedom and my manhood, and to have half of it shaved off. What is he saying? You're half a man. You're practically a slave. And then to do the same thing with the clothes. Can you imagine cutting someone's shirt in half and making them wear half a shirt and then sending them home like that? "Oh, yeah, you comforters, consolers. Here's what I think of your get-well card, David." Oh, boy. You know, when David wants to show you kindness, you let him show you kindness. Now, it was humiliating. And so he said, well, stay in Jericho there. Don't come back to Jerusalem until your beards grow back. Because they were humiliated. And so what we see is that when the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious, stinking in the sight of David, or in the nostrils, we've become a bad smell in the nostrils of David. The sons of Ammon sent and hired the Arameans of Beth Rehob and the Arameans of Tzobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army, the mighty men, and the sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Tzobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Now when Joab saw that the battle was set against him in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans, but the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. So David was none too happy about the shaving and cutting incident. And when the Ammonites realized, man, this was, we might as well have declared war because we're in trouble now, they hired a bunch of guys, tens of thousands of these other guys, the Arameans from all these different places, and men of Tob, and getting these guys, quick math here, 33,000. A lot of guys. And when Joab, the commander of David's army, was sent out with the army, the mighty men, to go fight these guys and say, hey, I sent you a get well card, you tore it in half, send it back, here's what you get. Joab found an interesting situation. He found a battle that he was about to wage on two fronts. Now, one thing you could do is you could attack the city, but then the guys in the field would come and attack you in the rear. Well, you could attack the guys in the field, but then the guys in the city would come and attack you in the rear. Down to the hips, you might say. And so he got this great idea. Let's divide the army into two armies and fight it on both fronts. That way nobody's coming up from behind on us. And he says this. He says, if the Arameans, saying to his brother Abishai, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come to help you. Be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they fled before him. When the sons of Ammon saw that the Arameans fled, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. Guess what? It worked. They were victorious. Why were they victorious? You'd think, you can't divide. Remember, the Bible talks about division as being bad. Well, there was two armies now. And the good thing, the reason they succeeded was this. Joab said, Abishai, if you see me in trouble, come and help me. And if I see you in trouble, I'll come and help you. Now, unfortunately, this isn't the way the Christian army works. Because what happens is the Christian army, when people see me in trouble, they applaud. They cheer. They say, see, God wasn't with him. You deserve what you get. Oh, look, he's wounded. Let's put him out of his misery. And unfortunately, when we see other folks that are struggling in the battle, we do the same thing. You know, that's so tough. We're so willing to jump on anybody who's losing the battle. You know, we look at somebody who's struggling. Struggling in the battle against sin, and as soon as we find out about it, what do? Oh, we disfellowship them. Forget that, Matthew 18. Forget repentance. We disfellowship them. We get angry at them. We yell at them. We scream at them. We tell them they're not really saved. They're losing the battle, and we call them a loser instead of helping them out. Instead of saying, you know what? If you're struggling against this, you call me, and I'll be there. It's a James Taylor song, I think. You call me and I'll be there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But honestly, have you done that for anybody? Does anybody call you at 2 in the morning and say, I'm about to drink this bottle unless you stop me? Does anybody call you at 3 in the morning and say, I've got a gun here? And I guess I just wanted to say goodbye. And you know it's a call for help. You know it's a call to race down there and stop them or to keep them on the phone. You know, we're losing the battle. You know, and if we were all doing that, I wouldn't get all the calls at 2 in the morning and 3 in the morning. We'd be supporting one another. And, oh, Lord forbid, if for some reason I was losing the battle. Because that's part of the problem with the stool and the microphone or the pulpit and the stage or whatever. Because you know, oh, you might say, surely not I, Lord, you know, as Peter said to Jesus. But I know that if I ever began to lose the battle, people would leave in droves, accuse me of being an apostate and whatever else. And that's not how you win wars. It's not how you're victorious in the battle. You know, if I see you struggling, I'm not going to forsake you. I'm going to try and help you win. I hope that I never lose the battle. I hope that I'm never losing. But I know that there will be times in my life that I am. And I'd like to think that I wouldn't have to hide behind a veil of a black shirt and a white collar or whatever, and a smile and a Bible. I'd like to think that you would say, hey, you're losing the battle. Let me come help. And it's not a guilt trip that I'm laying on you for me. I'm hoping that you'll see that as a Christian army, we will never win unless we begin to help one another when we're losing the battle. And that's for everybody. That's for everybody. It's for each one of us. You know what? If you're here and you're struggling in sin, or you know, you've been fighting against the devil and losing every day, don't be afraid to come talk to me. Because when I see you losing the battle, I want to help. I don't want to shoot you. I don't want to stand there and go, well, tough luck. You know, Abishai could have thought, you know, if Joab, my brother, you know, he's the commander of the army, if his army loses and my army wins, I'll be the commander of the army. Start being self-seeking. How many of us have found ourselves thinking that, you know, especially when you start becoming a active church in the community, you know, a growing church, and you see other ones stumbling or falling, or just maybe they're the next most popular one and you know they don't do things right the way we do, and what are you doing? You're going, Lord, that building sure is nice. Lord, maybe there could be some big controversy there and everybody leaves and they have to sell it and they sell it to us for next to nothing. I've never thought these things. I'm merely speculating. Okay, sometimes I lose the battle, all right? You know? And instead of that, praying. Anytime I find myself thinking, this is all honest truth before God and man, when I find myself thinking stuff like that, and I guess that's a confession of sin, when I find myself thinking like that, Lord, that church has only got 20 people left, would you just shut the doors? You know? I realize it's wrong, and I continually pray this, Lord, if your people are in there, bless them. Bless them abundantly. If there's sin, remove it. And if there's a remnant, strengthen them and multiply them and increase them. That's my prayer. My prayer very often, not every day, but at least every week, Lord, shut down every church in this town that has no remnant, that has no word, that has no spirit. Shut them down. Because they're just using up oxygen and they're making the kingdom of God look bad. But Lord, where there's a remnant, bless them abundantly. You know, if God does everything that I believe he wants to do in this town, one church isn't enough. Two churches aren't enough. Well, what if they seed 1,000 people? Three churches isn't enough. If we're doing the work that I know God wants us to do, then I believe there could literally be a church on every block that's got 500 people in it. Because isn't that about how many people live on a city block? And so, it's not just one-on-one. It's group-to-group, army-to-army. Yeah, the army doesn't fight in the same place. You know, we're in a different part of town or maybe ministering to a different group of people than some church down the road. And so, I would like to think that if we heard they were losing the battle, that we'd be lifting them up, strengthening them, encouraging them in prayer if they won't receive it practically. And I'd like to think there's folks that do the same for us. And we probably can't control that on a citywide basis, but we can control that on an individual basis. If I see you falling, if I see you losing the battle, may God strengthen me to strengthen you. And if you see me doing the same, may you not go, well, he's a pastor. He starts losing the battle. I'm gone. May you do the same for me. May we do the same for each other. That's how they were victorious. That's how they won the battle. When the Aramaeans saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together, and Hadadezer sent and brought out the Aramaeans who were beyond the river. And they came to Helam, and Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, led them. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. And the Aramaeans arrayed themselves to meet David and fought against him. But the Aramaeans fled before Israel. And David killed 700 charioteers of the Aramaeans and 40,000 horsemen and struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings, servants of Hadadezer, saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them, so the Aramaeans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. You know, before they were going, we're making a lot of money hiring ourselves out as mercenaries to these Ammonite characters. When they saw the result of this war, they're like, sorry, we're not taking that job. So, the Lord's victory again. Now, let me tell you, I don't know how short today was. By my clock, it was only 3 pages. But I wanted to stop here because I think it's important to put a line of differentiation maybe between these chapters and when we get into chapter 11 and 12. Because it gets worse. I mean, David is doing great. And like we said, David had a heart of gold, but he also had a problem with wives, with women. And a big problem with... Actually, his problem was he didn't have a problem with women, I think. But, you know, those redheads, those are good-looking guys. And so we're seeing David at the highest of highs, and what we're going to see next week is David at the worst David ever gets. And, you know, we lift David up as a righteous man, a godly man, a man to be imitated, and... I don't know what it's going to show us. Maybe it'll all show us something different. But I wanted to put a line of differentiation there. I wanted to get a week in between them. If you read ahead, you're going to be disgusted with David. Because he's going to do things that you would never do. I hope, I pray that you would never do. And so I wanted to take a week to meditate on it and to think through it, to read through it more times, to study it more, to let God speak to me and let God speak through me to you about that. Because I think God's got a lot to say through the next couple chapters. So let's bow our hearts in prayer.